This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, it's Where We Vote, our series of interviews with candidates for top office where you get a chance to ask questions. Today, it's Republican Joe Visconti, who's petitioning his way onto the November ballot. He says he's got enough signatures. We'll find out soon. It's a crowded race with incumbent Governor Dan Malloy running again against Tom Foley, the former ambassador. But joining Visconti as a petitioner is John Pelto. These two men seemingly have little in common, but they share a desire to get rid of the Common Core state standards and are challenging their party's establishments. Visconti is running on a platform that's been largely identified by his opposition to gun control measures, but he's also tackling the state budget deficit and will ask some of his ideas. You can join the conversation. Call us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can always comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're also streaming live through CTN, the Connecticut Network, today. Joe Visconti, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, John.
Why are you running for governor?
That's a great question. This morning I was getting a coffee at Dunkin' Donuts, and I was thinking of my dad, a Marine who's left us. I lost him on the trail in 08 running for Congress. And I remember growing up, my dad had an accident at 8 years old where he cut his almost completely off his foot right in front of me at 8 years old. We lived out in Tallinn. And from 8 years old to about 14, I became my dad's everything and the family's everything. And I remembered asking myself whenever Dad called, JoJo, he'd call me, I need you. We got to do this. We got to do that. And, well, I want to do this, Dad. It's sports. And I had to put a lot of that down when I was young, but I didn't feel the it was a loss or sacrifice. But again, I put a lot down of what I wanted to do myself personally. And I'm doing that today at 57 years old. A lot of things I'd like to do personally, like everyone else, live a great life, make a lot of money, and have all those things. I've had that calling, not for my dad this time, but for love of the community versus love of the family. And that kind of came to me this morning because I figured you'd ask that question. It came in intuitively. And I hear my dad in the background, you can do your sports later. You can do your theater later. You can do that later. We got things to do. And EJ, you know, couldn't walk. They had 3 or 4 years of fusion operations on his ankle. Mm. So, but not out of sympathy. It was a great time. And so today, it's kind of funny because we moved to Hartford and I was surrounded by my good friend was John Ritter. I lived in the West End, went to Noah Webster, completely around the governor's mansion. And so it was kind of that brought me to the West End with all the politicos. And I find myself today going, wow, what a full circle.
What helped you formulate the political opinions that you have today?
Well, my dad was a Marine. My mom was a Goldwater Republican. And so my mom probably led me more towards the Republican Party at a young age. I remember when on the school bus when Johnson was running against Goldwater and everyone was fighting on the bus and all that. And I just watched it as a young man. And I didn't I liked the free enterprise and the freedom because at that young age I had my bicycle in the West End and I'd go shopping for mom and dad or the hardware store or go to work with dad and help him. So I had a lot of adult freedom at a very young age. I've been in trades for over 50 years, being 57 years old. So that freedom where you can go out, make a buck, you can go out and bring your bottles back you find in the field for return bottles, a shovel walks. I liked the free enterprise. And then moving to West Hartford, a lot of my Jewish friends, we left Buckley High. It was the West End. I mean, the Hartford got very, very rough in the early 70s. And then a lot of my friends were all Jewish at Hull High. And their parents were all self-employed. So, again, I found that self-employment, that free enterprise, that Marine mentality of my father, don't wait for somebody to give you a job. Get out there and do it. And that kind of at the younger ages probably – although most of my family on my mom's side are Democrats and good friends and workers of John Larson's, it's kind of funny. The old Dem guard I would be closer to than the Democrat Party today. I believe in the I'm against injustices. I feel for the poor. I've got an Emmy Award from a TV program I produced with a group of people in Miami for 5 years called Disabilities and Possibilities. I do have a bleeding heart for a lot of those causes in my biography. But again, I'm leaned more towards free enterprise and the Constitution and the Republic as the primary motivator.
We're talking with Joe Visconti. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. He's petitioning his way onto the ballot in November. The deadline passed, I guess, a few weeks ago now. When do you think you're going to know if you're actually on the ballot? And can you tell me roughly how many signatures you think you got, legitimate signatures that will be counted?
We know what we have exactly.
Okay.
I tried to run as a Republican in the primary. We cut our teeth on that run. very hard to find Republicans. We were getting close, but we couldn't get there. And I decided that I looked at the whole picture by the feedback from the public, and they were saying, we want you on the ballot. We don't care what your party is. And it woke me up to that reality. So we delivered physically to 169 towns, all towns of Connecticut, 10,200 signatures.
And the threshold's 7,500.
And then we brought in approximately 250, I believe, to the Secretary of State on the last day. So we're at 10,500. Most of them, I would say over 50% came from a referendum. That means that the signatures came from people that have an I voted tag. Naugatuck, we picked up 1,400 signatures with 18 volunteers in one day in one location. It's probably historic. All volunteer.
So again, these are folks who you know have voted already.
Correct.
You're catching them coming out. And so as long as they're filling out the paperwork properly and you're turning in the paperwork properly, this is a legitimate signature.
Oh, we believe so. At the gun stores at Kaufman's, we were there every day, and other gun stores across the state. That was a slower approach. People came to our tents, and we knew them. It was the pro 2A vote, and what's your party? And you know, we did all that. So the Stop and Shops are always, which we did about 15 of them across the state. Those are quick moving people. So if there's errors or people didn't know they couldn't vote, it would come from Stop and Shops where people are moving quickly. But we put a 30% buffer in, approximately 30%, which is about 3,000 extra signatures. You know, it's kind of funny because when I fought Blue back in West Hartford years ago, we used to have to get 4,500 signatures and or 42 or whatever. But those are from people I didn't realize until this gathering process that knew me. They knew the issue. They did, you know, these are people that don't know you.
Yeah. And again, Joe Visconti ran against John Larson for the first congressional seat back in 2008. And so he's well known to many Connecticut voters. Again, you can call us at 860-275-7266. Before we get into some of the issues, I just want to talk about this process that you've had to go through. We've been talking about this, including with the Secretary of the State. Do you think that the process for petitioning candidates to get on the ballot in November is too restrictive? Do you think it's about right? Tell me a little bit about what you found through this experience.
It's exactly perfect. Somebody knew what they were doing, and I didn't know that until it was over, because the threshold to pierce the veil of ignorance about who you are. And this came out before the Citizens Election Program for grant free money. I call it welfare. So I believe the process was years ago. It's a threshold that you have. If you can do this accurately, I mean, and not pay for it. We're all volunteer. We did not pay anyone to do this. You can be governor, because enough people you've interacted with. We had a great success rate of signatures. But the process is arduous. It should be. You have to be prepared. As a nominating petition gatherer, we had from January 1st till August 6th. I didn't get into this until June 10th, so we did it in 7 weeks. Jonathan, I don't know the date he started, but you could have. Under nominating started in January, so this is why the process is good.
But, of course, as you said, you got a head start because you were actually running a primary, and you had some interface with Republican voters, and so you got a little bit of a head start. Jonathan Pelto didn't. Why do you think it was harder to get Republicans to come over to your side? And what makes you different than Tom Foley? I mean, what's the choice here for people who want to vote Republican but have now Joe Visconti or Tom Foley to vote for?
Okay. Two parts of the question. The process for Jonathan was probably he didn't have a field. I'm a Tea Party leader, one of the people at the very beginning who formed it. So we had a great base of libertarian, constitutional people that I've been out in the streets with for years. Between being elected as a town council in West Hartford, running for Congress, and all the things I've done to work on party building in the Republican Party, I had that going for me. So that's probably one reason Jonathan may think it's a little harder. I do think that there's some nuances with the Secretary of State about the process of birth dates and signatures, are they clearly read and all that. Those are things that hopefully don't have to get challenged by Jonathan. As far as Tom Foley myself goes, listen, I like Tom. I voted for him in 2010. He is a great guy. He's done a lot for the party nationally, raising money for George Bush. Your listeners may like to hear that. But, I mean, as far as a Republican goes, he's that. Why I'm in the race is because of the failures that Tom has brought into not just stand up for as a conservative Republican, and you've got to follow this golden rule of being like this, but the budget's in front of me. The budget, the public is so intelligent today, and they are so with the social media, they know things. They want answers and they want details and they want to see a budget. I will put one out. Tom Foley won't even address the micro issues. He's staying away from it because it's political suicide in the old school to speak the truth and details about money and budgeting and things like that. Governor Malloy believes there's no deficit. So the problem with the governor is he's living in denial. Tom, a few other things. Tom's a waffling on Common Core. He's been in education. Again, I'm not going to be negative. I'm just going to characterize the differences. He wants to wait right now to find out if he wants to oppose Common Core. So he's not standing firm against it. The Second Amendment, there's been this huge argument, even from some of my comrades at the Citizens Defense League, where they believe I can't force a repeal. Well, I can actually put in, you know, we've studied the law. We have lawyers. We can put in repeal bills from the governor's office. My plan is to put bills incrementally in, first of all, for magazine limitations. But before we do anything, to actually have the governor hold a public hearing, something that was never done on the Second Amendment and the Connecticut Constitution as far as guns, and also a bill on what's determined an assault weapon. Tom wants to have it both ways. He's trying not to lose what he believes. What Tom's missed out is, though, the Q poll that came out showed that the public agrees with the Sandy Hook with the gun bill, SB 1160. But in a second question, the Q poll came out this spring. Did it go too far? Yes, the majority believe it went too far.
Well, I want to spend some time actually talking about gun control and some of the laws that were passed in the wake of Sandy Hook. But let's just talk a little bit about the politics of you taking on Tom Foley. So you say he's a good guy. You voted for him once before, but he is thin on specifics. I think that even he would acknowledge that. We have certainly reported that. We've asked him over and over again for specifics. Well, and he says, I don't want to give specifics. Yeah. So here's the thing, though, Joe. Is there a way, if you want to see a Republican run this state, is there a way for you to work within the party structure and get Tom Foley to actually make some of these decisions and say what he's going to say? Because a lot of people, just like they're saying, John Pelzer, you're going to take votes away from Dan Malloy, people are saying, you take a couple thousand votes away from Tom Foley, he's not going to be the next governor.
I'll either get traction and take this race in a 3 or 4 way, or I'll be irrelevant. And so the irrelevancy, in other words, Tom needs to win by a lot more than 6,400 votes. And if I didn't know the inside campaign manager, who was my RTC chair in West Hartford, we caucused for years, if I didn't know the thinking of the inside of his camp, and if I wasn't an insider at the highest levels of the GOP establishment, fundraising and working with the chairman and a host of other things that the public is not aware of, then I wouldn't know how they think what they're attempting. But beyond that, again, I don't want this to be a pile-on Tom Foley hour here, but the reality is Tom doesn't connect. He doesn't have the working class persona that I have. I'm a contractor. I'm a builder. I've been through hard times. I've been up. I've been down over the decades. I connect with Democrats, unaffiliated. It's not just persona, but it's who I am. That comes through. It comes through on the street, which is why the Secretary of State's numbers are so important. You're not going to get them unless you really connect and stand there with the people. But Tom, beyond that, is failure to he slept in, and now he's saying he needs 8 years. He wasn't paying attention. He's had 3 years to run this. I keep seeing stumble after stumble. This is why I stayed in the race. I kept watching him. I'm not going to go through another Linda McMahon show and at the end of the day have our party, our brand, or the conservative message diluted or not articulated, and we lose.
And just before I take a break, you've seen your party do this now a couple times. Tom Foley, rich guy from Greenwich, getting a couple cracks at the governor's office. Linda McMahon, a rich woman from Greenwich, getting a couple cracks at higher office. Do you think that the Republican Party has turned away from working class people, and essentially it's about let's try to run somebody with a bunch of money for a bunch of people with money?
I don't think it's about the money. We all grew up with the millionaire TV show. Remember when we were kids? You all wanted to be rich. It's not about the money. It's not about the Tom's rich.
I work in public radio. I didn't have I Want to Be a Millionaire T-shirt.
Oh, come on. The TV show back in
oh,
the 60s. Remember?
Okay.
The millionaire. He would hand out checks for $1 million. Like, wow, I wish you could. Everyone wanted to be rich.
I was listening to Terry Gross. I was a nerdy kid.
It's not about money. Yeah. It's not about his wealth, because that's admirable for the wealth he made for who he is. I don't even think the people believe it's the money. It's the inability to connect, to talk to details, to be on the ground, in the game, And I mean really have his
head
in there.
But isn't that what part of the problem of the Republican Party now? It's that the money actually does stratify. It actually does take you out of the ability to be able to connect with people. People talked about Tom Foley getting out of the back seat of a BMW at that Sprague mill, and then everything sort of went badly after that. Is there a problem with Republicans sort of allowing money to set them apart from the common person?
Yes. Yes. And why? Listen, I've broken bread and been part of the establishment. When I go to the RTCs all year, we went to all the RTC meetings. I've been part of everyone. I know everyone in the party. And it's not about that they're all wealthy, but they see money as the tool, the instrument, not realizing that it's important. But Linda McMahon should not have been just a different kind of senator. Tom Foley, not just a new direction. These are empty slogans that mean nothing. And people know that. So what is the new direction? What are the better solutions? He's not giving them that strategy. We'll lose. Malloy will get back in if he continues to run that strategy.
We're talking with Joe Visconti. He's petitioning on to the ballot in November. He's running for governor. He's a Republican. We'll take your calls when we get back. 860-275-7266. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's a continuation of our Where We Vote series, where we give you a chance to ask questions of candidates for top office. And today we're taking a look at the governor's race with Joe Visconti. He's a petitioning candidate. He's a Republican, but he's trying to get onto the November ballot. We'll find out very soon if he got the necessary number of signatures. He says that he did, and so he very well will get into what could be a four-way race with Tom Foley and Governor Dan Malloy and also Jonathan Pelto. Let's go to the phones, 860-275-7266. Charlie is calling from Derby. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, sir. Mr. Visconti, I have a question for you, a statement then a question. Every Democrat in this state has been opposed to the three tribes getting their federal recognition. As a matter of fact, they've been able to insert a third-party clause, which goes ahead and lets them backdate their objections so that the third party, so the tribes cannot get their federal recognition. If the tribes get their federal recognition, I do not see how it cannot be but a win-win for the state of Connecticut and win-win for every town in this state. And I'm just trying to find out your stance on how you feel about the recognition of the three remaining tribes in the state.
Charlie, thank you for the question. Joe Visconti?
I believe they should get their federal recognition. They should have a chance. The three-party rule, third-party rule where someone can make a complaint and then you'd have to get their permission to go back. It's a death blow. Blumenthal's all over this trying to block it. We don't know why. I think either the two tribes that are left that are in the Bridgeport area is a place that I've talked about before, and I think it's a perfect opportunity. I think some of the tribes are looking at swapping land and giving up land claims that were imposed by Blumenthal. I think there's somewhere around 5,000 to 10,000 jobs that could be created. But I don't like the third party rule. I believe this fall, the Indian Bureau of will be ruling on their new rules for this. It's a death blow, this third party block, and I think it was put in by the Democrats. I don't know why. I don't know if there's casino money, if there's Atlantic City or gaming money, industry money coming. But Bridgeport would be the perfect place for a casino. Atlantic City's failing. I think this month we just had another decrease in funds from the Mohegans and Foxwoods. Not necessarily increased gaming, but I think that it's also I think there's a few hundred Indian tribes in America that are still waiting for recognition.
Well, one thing is that the recognition piece of it is probably one separate conversation.
It is.
The conversation about whether or not it's a good idea to have a casino in downtown Bridgeport, you just said that the other two casinos have been on the rocks over the course of the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Maybe there's not enough gambling money out there. New casinos going into Massachusetts. Atlantic City's dying. Do we really need to bring a casino to downtown Bridgeport?
I think that the recognition process, what the caller spoke about, I brought up the casino area because I know it's you can't say recognition without saying casino.
Yep.
And so they're politically connected. New York, though, is the that's the winner because your vicinity, 40, 55 miles from New York City, where a lot of people come in. So the casino is one issue, but I don't like the fact that Blumenthal, Himes, and Governor Malloy have signed letters trying to block this and have pushed for this third-party rule with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And I think I think those tribes need to, or supporters of just the recognition, need to be addressed.
I want to get to some more phone calls, and thank you for your earlier phone call. Derek in Windsor. Hi there, Derek. Go ahead.
How are you, John? As usual, good job. But to your point that you made to the senator, I don't know, even sure if he's a senator. I just tune in. But
he's running. He's running for governor. Go ahead, Derek. Yeah.
All right. To your point that you made to him about the a bunch of rich Republicans trying to get into power so that they can, you know, defend the rich folks, so to speak. I totally agree with that. And, you know, we all know that politics is about big money these days. And to your point, Obama has proposed a minimum wage for workers, and I don't think there is one Republican that really backed that. So that goes to show that they are not about working class people. They are really about their rich friends.
Well, Derek, let me put that question, and thank you for raising the minimum wage. I was going to talk to Joe Visconti about that. What do you think about the idea of a higher minimum wage, a minimum wage of $10.10 an hour, which is what the state has moved toward? Maybe even a minimum wage that gets closer to what many call a living wage, $15 an hour, so people can actually afford to, you know, pay for groceries.
Well, I'm already on the record for that. And again, there's a difference between Tom Foley and myself. He supports the minimum wage. I think a couple days ago he came out now trying to flip-flop on that and saying he wants a tiered system under 21 years old. The small business owners, this is where I'm going to go, to the heart of Connecticut right now, and you'll look at in this the budget here right in front of me, you'll see that the business revenue is decreasing a couple percent in the last 2 years, and it's going to continue to decrease. That's because small businesses are leaving. Revenue's not coming in. They're mopping their own floors at pizza parlors and restaurants. They're not going to hire those young kids because all their other workers will want more. In a recession, it's the horrible thing to do, not because the people don't deserve the money, but because we're still in a recession. The rest of America has moved forward. We haven't. So I think that it's a political move to try to pander. I'm not wealthy. I've worked for minimum wage before in my life, and I'm a builder. I've hired people on minimum wage. It's not – the minimum wage is just a standard that you shouldn't enter with. Here's another idea on the minimum wage that I think is really important. I've looked at – if you look at my website for welfare entitlement reform, I'm looking to bring in a prorated system for welfare reform. The people that, and the women that are trapped at minimum wage, and not just the young, but more importantly the women that are trapped in poverty, I want to have a prorated system. And that was brought to me by some people that have escaped the cycle of poverty. And so the services and the help that the state and the government give can continue up. They shrink as they follow them so they can really get a wage of $18, $24 an hour and move out of poverty and not sink in. So the minimum wage is a trap. It sounds good.
So explain this tiered system
again.
Prorated
system,
yeah.
Where as they move forward, benefits, even cash assistance, anything we need to get them on a cycle to move out of poverty, this it follows them so they're not limited by $10 an hour and then you all of a sudden you lose your benefits.
So there's not this gap where once I start working, all of a sudden I can't really pay for anything.
I want to raise the safety net and shrink it. It's called a prorated system. That was brought to me by voters, brought me the idea that came out of poverty.
So what about this idea, though, when it gets back to the minimum wage? Often people say, well, it's the pizza parlor, and people talk about the mom-and-pop shop. Yes, it's the pizza parlor, but most of these minimum wage jobs are really dealing with Walmart. They're dealing with big employers that could afford to pay more money to people in Hartford and Bridgeport to come to work.
I'm glad you brought the big employers up because if you've looked at the Connecticut Mirror and a couple of my other interviews, if we have to have tax increases – if we have to, and we're looking at this budget, we will be putting a budget out. And it may be impossible not to have some increases in taxation if you really are fair and look at the budget and not want to throw everything out.
Yeah.
And so I've made the claim as a Republican, this is a blow the socks off a lot of people, the first place we need to look is the major corporations. So I'd rather take it from them in taxation in Connecticut and not let them we can't force them to make full-time workers. We can try to force them with the minimum wage. I'd rather hit them with their billion-dollar profits, with their offshore expenses, the things that they're doing right now, and not to hurt them hard, but to take a point or point or two. We're looking at the numbers for majors. This is not small businesses, not small corporations, 50 employees. This is large corporations.
Large corporations that are based in Connecticut or large corporations that are multinational? Because a lot of people will say, you do that to corporations based in Connecticut, Joe, they're going to pick up and they're going to move someplace more friendly to Texas.
That's the trap Governor Malloy fell into,
okay.
trying to bribe billion-dollar industries to stay here. I'm not falling into that trap. They're going to stay here because Connecticut's beautiful. It's centrally located between New York and Massachusetts. It's perfect place for a corporation to be.
You don't think the corporations move because of a larger tax burden? That's the thing a lot of Republicans say.
It's not going to be enough of a tax burden to hurt them. But we also need to ease regulation, certain regulations on them. And that's what I'm talking to major businesses for. We start that once we're on the ballot to find out what it is they want from the state government that can help them reduce their costs that's a burden to them. The red tape. Tom Foley talks about it. What's the red tape? What is the bureaucracy that they want taken off, because in exchange for that, if we can relieve pressure on them in places that they think for their industry is a problem, then I want another piece.
How is lessening regulations based on what companies want you to do any different than giving them a tax break because that's what they want? I mean, essentially, it's letting the company say, here's what we need the state to do if we're going to stay here.
Well, we need an excuse for them wanting to leave. What are the regulations that you're crying about that are so burdensome that you have to leave?
Yeah. Well, and so give us okay, an example. Well, yeah, give us this, an example this, of well, a regulation.
They're talking about sick leave. Okay, that's the big one. So let's talk about that. I want to have a conversation with major business leaders, and that's what we're going to do. And you can't do that until you're on the ballot. The problem I've had as a candidate, you've got to be on the ballot to actually have the credibility that they're going to sit with you. Yeah. Because you can get on the radio like I am today, and you can name names, you can call them out. We're not going to do that until we have a conversation with them. And the other thing and I'll get back to something really quick that I think we missed. Tom Foley's looking not to have union concessions. You're not looking to seek them. And that's another one of your questions. That ties in here right now. If you're going to not seek union concessions and you're going to need to fire people, Tom, and this is not a blame Tom, but this is a real important issue, then you should ask them for concessions before you possibly fire them. That's the same mentality I'm using with the major corporations. What is the burden that you have? I want to speak to them before we start to look at what we may want. It's the first place, because if you look at the pie chart, personal income tax is going to go up to 52% in Connecticut. And what, in 4 years, it's going to be 56% of the general revenue? How much burden on income tax are we going to put on the worker working, and especially the middle class?
So let's talk a little bit. And we're talking with Joe Visconti. He's a Republican running for governor. I want to talk about some of your tax plans and the ways to get at this budget here. You talk about the sales tax being a regressive tax,
yes,
something that you would like to see phased out?
Yes.
Okay, so help me make this pie chart whole here.
Sure.
So obviously you want less of a burden for income taxes. You want less of a burden, maybe no one.
I'll give you my elevator speech.
Okay,
ready?
Here's the elevator speech.
Okay, it's been on the trail.
I'll give you at least 30 seconds.
It's been on the trail for 6 months. Sales tax only as – not that income tax isn't something we want to tackle, but right now if you get a job and you're paying income tax, if you're not working, not paying income tax, the poor especially affected by the sales tax. But Connecticut is geographically located between New York with almost 9% sales tax, Massachusetts with 6%, and Rhode Island with 7%. They come through our state. Everyone, this is an interstate, cut-through state. Come here, buy our stuff. If we can make a move over years, let's say it's 7 years, to start phasing 7 or 8 years to phase out sales tax. Tom Foley heard this as I delivered it in front of him at a microphone down in the southeastern part of the state months ago, and then he picked up on it and saying, I want to take 0.35% or cut it 0.5%. This is his way of grabbing my ideas and other people's ideas and kind of making his own. But the reality is, only because of our location can Connecticut become a duty-free state eventually, become the provision state, which it was legally until 1959 by a vote of the General Assembly, and actually provide people to come through here, buy the big screen TV, get everything you want when you're in Connecticut, buy it here. Then you can actually look at the corporate revenues rise, and also you'll have an uptick in income taxes. People are going to get a full-time job, maybe at Walmart, or maybe they're going to have a full-time job and a pay increase. So you look at those two parts of the pie chart increasing. You tie it to inflation or tie it to GDP. Either way, the legislature can work on a plan to begin that process as a big-picture plan only because of our geography. It would not work anywhere else.
So with this plan and all the things that you're thinking about moving forward, we have the reality of about a $1.5 billion deficit moving forward into this next fiscal year and the following fiscal year. So it's not just that you've got to balance the books here. You've actually got to find some money. You're talking about union concessions. Where else you find this money?
Did I have 30 seconds or are we going to go on?
Oh, well, you know, it's public radio again. We can talk forever.
Okay.
But
okay.
Give us another 30 seconds.
This is the plan I put out in January before we all found out we had a $2.8 billion. So if we're going to look at tax relief, I think the sales tax is the place eventually, not until we can actually right the ship. And I've said Connecticut is a ship. This is a soundbite, but it's true. Financial is a ship sinking on fire that's drifting into the rocks. fully realizes that. The governor is in denial about that. Governor Malloy took us out of a ditch and drove us off a cliff. This is what he did. And so when we look at what we're going to do, I cannot see a way without union concessions. And this is why we're working hard with smarter people than myself at how we can balance the budget and even multi-year budgets coming up, because they're worse than just next year, without tax increases. And I'm not a promoter of tax increases. Let me say that loud and clear on the radio here. But if we don't get union concessions, and I mean whatever they can give, we're at their mercy. I'm asking them, tell us what you want. I'm looking at union work rules, modification, technology. We need to give more government services in a recession for people in an aging population with less money. It's like that old ACMAC commercial. ACMAC, I give them a plug. Less, more for less than on time. How are we going to deliver more services for less of a cost? It's the unions that have to help us. And they've helped us before. We need their help, or I can't see a way we don't have tax increases.
We got a couple of economic questions here for Joe Visconti. Chris is in Middlebury. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Back in the late 80s and into the 90s, I was selling to companies in Connecticut. I was selling to industries. I sold industrial interiors, and I sold products to companies that were moving out of state. They told me why they were moving, and I used to call Collins' WTIC show back in the mid-90s, and he didn't believe me. Generally, people on the left don't. Now you're starting to come around, but the reasons they're leaving are it's not just the level of taxation. It's the complexity of the taxes. Some of the manufacturers had 700 or more different levels of taxation they had to pay. The unions also have all ways of gaming the system that drastically drives up the cost of the production, which I could get into, but there isn't time. Let me just point this out, though. If you figure it out, on the average, a person will spend between sales taxes, property taxes, income taxes, everything else, nearly half their income goes to tax. Now, if a company that employs people has to pay each one of them enough so they can pay their taxes and keep enough to live, that means that the company's cost of employment, which are about 85% of their total cost of operation, half of that is going to just to allow people to pay their taxes, which means the companies have to nearly double the price of their goods when they sell to the next entity. Now, if a company starts as a farm or a mine or something, they have to nearly double their prices to sell to the next person who makes the next step of production. Generally, in production, you go through several steps, maybe as many as 8 or 9 or 10 before the final product reaches the end user, at which point, if you multiply out, you're going to find that costs of living go up astronomically because of taxation, and that's the problem. It's not the wage that's the problem. It's the cost of living, and a lot of that problems driven by taxes and ridiculous Democrat Party economic policies.
Chris, thank you very much for your phone call. Joe Visconti, do you have anything to add?
Want to work on my team?
I was going to say, I think maybe you may just recruit somebody.
There are 1,000 things. This is generational, John. This came to us in the last 40 years. We've tried to be everything to everyone in Connecticut. We've driven manufacturing out of here, and it's not just the unions. Because we're a very educated community in Connecticut, the people in Connecticut, we want more. We can provide more. We have had that. We've all grown up here in Connecticut. We know what this is. I'm a Republican conservative, but I love Connecticut, and I want to keep as much of Connecticut as we can. We're just losing so many people that we're native Connecticut, and they're moving south, people from Connecticut, retiring south, and we're getting a flood of coming in from New York. We're getting other people. People will come in. The real question is, why do people have to lose their home, leave their home, break up their families, and move south because of economics? Is there a way that they can stay here longer? And I don't think the governor or Tom Foley, either one of them, are fair about the next 5 to 7 years in Connecticut. Never mind looking at just 1.4 million, 2.8 billion, or even there's projections for 4.8 billion in the next 3 to 4 years. These horror stories. We need to look at it so that we can give these people time to leave. If they've got to leave because we're broke, we have to give them time.
One more call before this break. Pete is in New Haven. Hello, Pete.
Hey, thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on. Joe, I like your attitude, like your demeanor. I really like what you have to say. I just have one point, and I'd like to hear what your standpoint is. When Governor Rell, when she was in office, the only thing that she could have ever hung her hat on that said, look what I did for Connecticut, was she had an opportunity to get rid of automobile property taxes on cars. And then it got shot down because they said only the rich would be affected by it because they're the ones driving Rolls Royces and Lamborghinis. And if we take away property taxes, then they won't have to pay taxes on those cars. All she could have done was say, hey, listen, if you really feel that way, let's stop it at $50,000. $50,000 and below, if that's the value of your car, no property taxes. $50,000 and above, if you can afford to order a car that much, you're going to have to pay property tax on it. That would be a huge relief to families in Connecticut, just automobile property taxes alone. You're a contractor. You've had a couple of trucks. You know when the tax bill comes. It's horrible.
Well,
now, but wait, people are going to say, how do you replace that money? Where does it come from? Listen, People drive through this state nonstop every day, and we have no tolls at the borders. I know they took them off for safety, but if we tolled our borders and at least recovered some of that income, you could replace the property taxes for cars that we wouldn't have to pay, and that would take it off.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to let Joe Visconti just jump in. There are people who are clearly running for governor alongside you, Joe Visconti. They've got some interesting ideas. Well, so talk about this. He's asking about motor vehicle taxes, and he's talking about tolls at the borders.
Right.
What do you think?
Great. I've already run on a record on both of those. First of all, the property tax, the caller brought it up. How do you replace it? Anything you give the General Assembly, they're just going to suck up and spend somewhere else. How do you stop them from spending? So this is the big problem we have with any more new revenue. Even this is why looking at sales tax phase out is something, because it sends the mindset, wait a second, we're going to get less from somewhere? Oh, my God, they stopped thinking spending. So I oppose it today, even at certain limits, because we are sinking on fire, drifting into the rocks as a sailboat, okay, as a state. So these are good ideas after we come out. The tolls, we're working right now. We're going to be calling the Department of Transportation to find out, because I've said this on the record, how can we put tolls in without backing, at least in Fairfield County, without backing traffic up to the GW Bridge? How do you feasibly do it? Worse than that, or better than that, how do you do it under 7 years of construction and tying it up like the Kew Bridge? How do you do that in the Gold Coast? I can't see a way for us to do that there. If any of the callers have a better way or find a way,
we did a whole show on this. Congestion pricing. Yeah, you put passive tolls right over the roads.
Yeah. Will the DOT allow that, or will this become a 5 to 7 year project gets torn up in the roads like the Kew Bridge?
Because it's not going to be toll booths like the old days. That's for sure.
Well, that's the big question we have. We want to see a feasibility study or something. I'm sure the DOT's got something on it.
Well,
but I would be for it if we can find a way not to back it up, because the problem is it's a parking lot right now in 95.
If you want to learn more about congestion pricing, we did a show on this. You can go to WNPR.org right now. If you want to stay tuned after this break, we'll talk more with Joe Visconti. We're going to talk about guns in Connecticut. He's a candidate for governor. He is petitioning his way onto the ballot in November. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We will discuss the week's news, from ongoing protests in Ferguson, Missouri, to the governor's race here in Connecticut. We'll be joined by Colin McEnroe, as always, and we'll welcome a new panelist, syndicated political cartoonist Tom Tomorrow. That should be fun. That's tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, we're continuing our Where We Vote series with Joe Visconti. He is a former town councilman in West Hartford. He made a run for the first congressional seat back in 2008. He's a contractor, and he's a Republican who is running for governor. He's petitioning his way onto the ballot in November. He says he's got enough signatures to get there, and so we're talking with him today and taking some of your calls and questions. We've got about 15 minutes to tackle two really big issues, so let's talk about guns and Common Core. The laws that got passed by Governor Malloy and the legislature in the wake of Sandy Hook. You've been opposed to these measures. Tell me exactly what you don't like about the laws that got passed after Newtown.
First, I don't like there wasn't a public hearing on the law. I think that's unconscionable that the legislature and the governor actually allow that to occur. What happens with that? Anger increases, revolt from people that believe in the Second Amendment, as I do. And I'm not a fair weather, just so you understand the background, I'm not a fair weather gun guy here. I've carried a gun for over 30 years. I was caught in the Mariella boat lift in the year 1980 with my sister working at the Diplomat Hotel on Miami Beach. I was doing waitering work at night after my construction work, putting kitchens in South Florida. And we came out of the restaurant and everyone was gone. There was gunfire on the streets. We lived in Broward County. Broward County had riots. Police were nowhere to be found. Cars overturned and gunfire at the end of the street outside our door. I had a steak knife. At 23 years old, I realized, oh, my God. And you're seeing this now in Missouri. Oh, my God. Overnight, something can happen. So I got involved when I got back at home. I had an AR-15s and I went to the Blue Trails Range. And so my background basically was realizing again, like tax increases, like a last resort, the Second Amendment is important. You need to protect yourself. My dad was a Marine, always said, you know, make sure you have the safe, have the stuff that you need. And so from that point of view, I believe that that Second Amendment is not just about a right to have bear arms, but it's a right to protect yourself, because I realized in the moment I couldn't protect my aunt or my sister. We're all – I had a steak knife in a drawer. And so that comes through your mind, not your own preservation, but those that you love. So for me, it got that hardcore. So when the governor did pulled this, this was 30 years. So it's not like, oh, my God, one day I'm a pop-up patriot and I all of a sudden I don't like this. But the Sandy Hook tragedy is something that they needed a response to. But I believe the liberal – I'm going to call it the liberal agenda, the Mike Lawlers of the world that we're seeking and are continuing seeking more and more legislation to remove in a Pollyanna world or a utopian world all guns from the planet, you know, and then we'll have a peaceful society. This is what I believe and what I see happening. So I knew that a tragedy was gamed politically. And you can see by the fact that they wouldn't let us speak.
But you said they needed to do something. So what could they have done?
Yeah, well, they needed to do something as legislators and the governor needed to do something because they had to respond to the constituents who were outraged. It was outrage. It's emotion. It's the worst time you want to pass laws, and especially without public hearings. So that was the process, I think, that was completely unconstitutional not to even have it. Some of the paperwork to have the emergency certification wasn't even filled out. You know the backstory on it. So that process was something that angered people right off the bat. The magazine limitations, I have two magazines. I registered them with the Department of Public Safety for my Beretta 380, and so they have that. Why did I have to do it? They already have the paperwork on my 380 at the state police when I bought it at Hoffman's in the 80s. So they have that, the serial number, the model. When I bought it, they knew what came with that gun. The data is already there for all of us legal gun owners. What was this magazine limitations for? When I had my AR-15s and I sold them years ago when I had kids, and for whatever reason I decided not to have them in the house – that was my personal decision. But the point was they have gun locks. These things were something that's already purchased legally. If things are purchased illegally, that would be something that they should have worked
on. Well, and of course, they broaden the definition of what is illegal. And
correct.
And you think that that went too far.
Of course it went. And that's what the Q poll proves. It went too far. Magazines, because it was erroneous for gun owners that are legal, legitimate, law-abiding. And most of them are Democrats. I can tell you by all the gun stores I work at to get signatures that the Democrats are majority, not necessarily Republicans or unaffiliated. Affiliate that like Democrats. So you can't call it a Republican thing here.
What's the problem with limiting the size of magazines?
Why limit it? Why do I have my magazine I can carry? I couldn't carry it here today because the school system. But why do I have to carry only one and keep 10 rounds in a magazine that holds?
Law enforcement officials say in mass shootings like the ones at Sandy Hook, if you have smaller magazines, that means that people can't get off as many
rounds
as
quickly. You mean crazy people? You mean crazy people?
Well,
or terrorists? Not legal people. I'm not going to do that. And the people I know, thousands of gun owners in Canada, are not going to do that.
But you talk about crazy people.
So this is what you're really dealing with.
But you and many others have talked about whether or not mental health reform needs to be front and center here, whether or not it's about guns or whether or not it's a mental health reform. So what did we do about mental health? What should we have done about mental health?
If you want to talk about a political trap, though, here's where I'm going to lean a little more Democrat idea with the American Civil Liberties Union. I do believe that that is such a ground we have to be careful to walk on. As you know, the gun law has it if you commit yourself that you have to turn your guns in, but if a doctor commits you, you don't. So there was errors in what they did there. Nobody wanted to touch the mental health issue, especially Democrats and liberals, because they didn't want to go down that road. And I don't know the answer for you for that, because it's – on a personal note – my grandmother was in Norwich Mental Institution when I was a little boy, in which we would be brought home. I remember giving my grandmother in the late 50s, early 60s, we would give her medication. And so we know – she wasn't violent, but she had medication. So I'm completely familiar what mental illness is, and as a personal level, and she lived with us her whole life. And I'm not ashamed of it, but I do know that there are people out there that don't fall into any violent behavior. And so you tell me how we're going to separate the violent behavior, because Adam Lanza's psychiatrist, definitely someone missed the boat there. So what is the answer? I don't think there is an answer.
So if there's not an answer on that, and we should be able to have as many guns as we want, how on earth can we not then have guns falling into the hands of people who will do bad things with them?
Well, you're going to get people that – this is why having gun safes, gun locks, and any gun owner, real gun owner knows what
to do. An irresponsible person doesn't have a gun safe. An irresponsible person raising a kid like Adam Lanza doesn't keep
John,
the guns locked up.
I can take it down to Home Depot. We can buy a gun that actually shoots nail guns on CO2, and someone could kill someone with that right now. Finish nailer. I have the ones that are that have air, but they have them with CO2. So you're not going to stop. This is the liberal. This is where I call the liberals crazy when they want to take it all away. You can't stop illegal immigrants coming across the border with drugs on their back. Yeah. You could never get rid of guns. So how you tell me how you'll stop
but
that?
Why is the argument? But why is it
leave
that
us
we
alone.
As a country? Why is it that we as a country have more guns? And we also have more gun violence than any other country in the world. Well, how can that possibly be?
You've put both those together.
Yeah.
You look at the statistics for legitimate, legal gun owners.
We have more guns
you put
as
them
a
together
society
in a sentence,
and we have more gun violence.
You have more gun violence because guns come. Either they're stolen or either someone buys them and doesn't lock them up and someone takes them from a family member. They come across the border with marijuana.
They commit suicide with them. They shoot people who shouldn't have been shot. They shoot their friends and neighbors. It does happen, Joe. It does.
And suicide by hanging? Was that number one? Suicide by poisoning? Come on, John.
Suicide by handgun is number one.
For the most part, the thousands of gun owners that I know are great guys made up of all parties.
I'm sure that's true. I don't doubt that.
The majority targets you. A sportsman, marksman, a Hartford Gun Club. This is not AR-15. There's the group, like when I was young at 23, and you have your AR-15s, and you go to the range, you follow the law, but you know you like to target shoot with that particular gun. And I've owned two of them. One was a nickel-plated, pre-ban. And so there are different levels that people have interest. Self-protection is one. Sport is probably bigger than self-protection. And you'll never win the argument on me. And America will never give up its guns. The liberals are never going to take them from us. And I'll do everything in my power to make sure that I put repeal bills in for the magazine limitation and to have a discussion on what is an assault weapon and why it is. What about school safety and why haven't we done anything about school safety? I want to see armed guards in every school in Connecticut. I've said this on the record. I want to see either military personnel that come back looking for work. They don't have to be police officers. We need to take a look at that because the feedback that I've gotten from moms and dads is I'm afraid to send my kids
to school.
We're
looking at what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri. Does militarization of our schools, does that help? Does having a guy with
they're
a gun in every school
they're
help?
Basically a shooting gallery. We've allowed them to become a potential shooting gallery.
But most schools aren't.
Most schools
are safe places where kids can go and learn.
By liberals do not want – well, come to West Hartford. There's a police officer right in front of the high schools, the middle schools. They're there. And why are they there, John?
We have 2 minutes left. We didn't even talk about Common Core. Tell me about the Common Core state standards because we're talking about education now.
It's finished. It's finished one way or the other. Jonathan Pelt, I want to give him a moment here because he's done a great job on his block pushing it. I fought it for years, even in West Hartford. I called it then, back in the day, the education cartel. Bureaucrats, social engineers, union bosses, teachers don't want it. Parents don't want it. Another failed bureaucratic program that removes local Board of Education control from the parents. And this is what I believe Connecticut, with all its 169 towns, love. They move here because they love the boroughs, the towns. They want local control. There are testing. There will always be mastery tests, standardized tests, but the government takeover. And worse than this, again, I'm a Republican, but the Bill and Melinda Gates monopoly takeover and the Pearson the textbooks industry and what they're doing for testing, the privacy laws of the testing where the children actually they have tests that are suggested. I mean, this hasn't even been rolled out yet. Data mining, Chromebook. I can go on for hours on it. It's the Obamacare of education, as I've called it. But the parents do not want to take a risk on Common Core as they did on Obamacare because it's one thing for your health. It's another thing for your child's mind, their development, and what they're doing that the parents don't have control of. Parental rights is probably number one.
Just very quickly, I'm just getting a note from my producers. I believe there were public hearings around the gun issue. I mean,
there was a public hearing that I spoke at, but not on SB 1160. Go YouTube Joe Visconti. It's called What's Next on YouTube. You'll hear me. But that is not on SB 1160. That's on another gun bill that had crazy things they wanted to do. That wasn't on the bill. So we never got a chance to have a public hearing on the bill.
On that specific bill.
The bill that's law now.
Okay.
And that you should do.
So, Joe Visconti, what do you hope to get out of this? We just have 30 seconds left. I mean, some people
are going to be your next governor, and you can't see it coming.
They're calling John Pelto a spoiler. I mean, are you a spoiler? You're going to take votes away from Tom Foley?
Tom Foley and Governor Malloy are spoilers because you know why? They're not telling you what's up. You'll never hear these details. You'll never hear positions on the issue. It's vague. And you don't know what kind of government you're going to get. Last thing I'd like to say, $35 million and counting of state taxpayers' money used for these elections. I'm not taking a dime from it. I'm living off the land. Joe Visconti for governor, viscontiforgovernor.com. Worse than that, the governor and Tom Foley both are taking $6 million. and I think it's unconscionable. How much money could have gone to WNPR?
Oh, yeah, you're right. That's where it's going to go. Joe Visconti, I'm not sure that we can agree on a whole lot, but it sure is fun talking to you. Thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, John.
You can continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown produced the program with Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.